And good morning. This is Walt Bodine, and I welcome you to the Walt Bodine Show for a round of discussion of things as they are and what are we going to be doing about them, I guess. We'll find that out as we go to our guest, and our guest will be introduced to you by Gina.
Hi, yeah, I'm Gina.
Gina Kaufman.
That's right. I am Gina Kaufman, and I am here with not only Walt Bodine, but also Eugene Halton, author of The Great Brain Suck and Other American Epiphanies. Good morning.
Good morning.
So the brain suck, let's define that quickly.
Yeah. Brain suck. Well, you know, we have a culture of technology and commerce, a techno culture that claims to be putting information, ever more information into us. We have more sources of information, television,
yeah.
The various media, various forms of screens. I just saw today that in the next year they're going to be enabling cell phones and you know, Blackberries to be able to receive television shows. So all of this information is pouring in, but somehow it seems as if it's pouring out the other ear, maybe, in one ear and out the other ear.
You're saying we aren't getting any smarter?
Yes. That in the very act of putting this information
yeah.
in, it seems to be depleting people of awareness of
yeah.
Of their surrounds, of you know, abilities to be where they are.
Right.
One thing I enjoyed in this book, your distinction between the brain drain and the brain suck. If you would share that with the listeners, I
yeah.
think that would be great.
Yeah.
Well, a brain drain is when you lose intelligence to other countries.
Mm-hmm.
And often other countries have been brain-drained by their best people coming to the United States.
Yeah.
Who knows, with the economy, we may be going the other way now. But brain suck, I mean something more that it's a loss of the presence of the person or the intelligence of the person into something like the zombie zone of the living dead.
Hmm.
So it's...
Boy, this is getting weird. You've just been here 10 minutes and you're already weird.
Well, there's a commercial that I thought of when I was reading
mm-hmm.
this book, where there's a guy on a mountaintop with like a laptop computer or
mm-hmm.
some kind of a gadget that allows him to check in with work. And the ad's premise is, you know, you can check work. You used to have to be in an office, but now you could be on a mountaintop. And it sounds like you're kind of saying the reverse, that you used to be on a mountaintop and now you're looking at a screen.
Exactly, yeah. You're not you're dislocated from your circumstance of the mountaintop.
Yeah.
You're taken somewhere else. You know, about a couple of months ago, I was leaving the campus at the University of Notre Dame where I teach, and I was driving, and I noticed a co-ed jogging with earbuds on. So I knew she was not going to look to see if traffic was coming.
Yeah.
And so I slowed down, and sure enough, she jumped in front of my car without looking. And then a pickup truck pulled up on the left and skidded to a stop, just missing her. And
really?
He was on the driver of the pickup truck was on a cell phone. She had some kind of iPod going on. Both of them had information pouring into them, but were removed from their present circumstances. They were made less aware of what was going on around them.
That's a dramatic illustration.
Yeah, and that's the information they were missing was maybe the most important at that moment.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now you are a professor, and I'm wondering how the college-age students you teach respond to some of the ideas in this book, the idea that progress, as we know it, is maybe not entirely progressive.
Well, I taught this book in a course last fall, and at first students, you know,
yeah.
seemed to wonder, well, what are you saying this is not progress? We did some things during the course that turned them around in different ways. I had a series of we had a fast experience where you could fast from time for as long as you wanted, either for 10 minutes or for, you know, a day, fast from computers, fast from cell phones. It was a kind of electronic fast, and I left the degree of difficulty up to the students. It was interesting. One student told me that she fasted from her cell phone for a couple of days. And it was difficult at first because she felt this need to be in contact with her friends.
Yeah.
I kind of expected that. And it was almost as if she went through something like withdrawal symptoms, you know, from the regularity of the habit of the cell phone. What I didn't expect as much was that her friends got upset with her for not being available to coordinate going to dinner or just to be in their network. And you started to see how much these students' identities are shaped in a network, almost like a spider web. If there's a disturbance, the whole network gets set off.
Yeah. It is hard to not participate in some of these things without incurring some ire from other people. Which brings me to another question. How are people supposed to function within this culture with a healthy relationship with technology? Do you have any ideas about how you can't change the entire culture. You can only change your own behavior.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. I mean, technology is a means for living. And that's, I think, the proper way we should approach it. If there's a use for technology to gain information or for transportation, for whatever, it should be something that we use to help us to realize our goals of life.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me the problem becomes when the technology usurps its place as a means and starts to become a goal into itself.
Yeah.
And we start to serve the system dictates of these devices.
Right.
So, for example, why should this student feel bad because she's not using her cell phone and this network of peer group pressure is pushing on her? It seems to me that's the ways in which systemically devices and technology can usurp their place. I think in many ways we should treat devices as slaves to be mastered by us and not to master us. The word robot originally comes from a Czech word, robota, which means slave-like labor. And, you know, we gave up slavery in the United States, but in some ways we actually displaced it onto machines. The evil of slavery is when you treat another person as a mere means and not as an end in themselves, that's
right.
Having their own goals. But when it comes to machines, it seems to me that they are only means and that we should be masters of the machines.
Mm.
And therefore, we should know how to turn them off. We should know how to turn off televisions, turn off devices. We should know how to be able to be aware and relate to other people. One of the things these devices do, and I think it's part of a shift in our culture, is to displace face-to-face and a kind of a tactile relationship into machine-mediated relationships. So what are the implications when, for example, 60%, as the Kaiser Foundation study showed, of children 1 year and younger spend at least an hour a day in front of a screen, or that 80% of children 5 or 6 and under spend 2 or more hours in front of a screen a day? When you go to those early ages, we have biological needs as young children to face our mothers, to face our parents, to face other people. And what does it mean to be displaced from face-to-face contact through a screen? I think in many ways, television, for example, can serve as a bad mother. A good mother is one who meets the child's needs. A bad mother is one who demands that the child meet its needs to buy things. And so what we have is a commercial culture intruding into the most basic kind of familiar relationships that are key for the development of the healthy self. So again, I think there are many ways in which we need to keep technology in its place. And when we do, it can be very useful.
You mentioned a lot the idea of colonialism, but that consumer culture can colonize a person's internal self. And that's related to this idea that watching TV has replaced, in some families, parenting.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, the author of the study, Vicky Rideout, for the Kaiser Foundation, put it this way. She said, there has been this sense that it is kids clamoring for media and parents trying to hold back the tidal wave. But what came out is that parents themselves are very enthusiastic about using media in their children's lives.
Yeah.
Many feel like they can't make it through the day without the assistance it gives. So, you know, what is the implication of parents allowing this colonization of their children into values that are about forming an identity through products instead of forming an identity that's grounded in the values of the family.
Products such as, or an example of such?
Well, some cool new toy that's going to make you cool.
Oh, yeah.
You know, some kind of a substance called cereal, which is actually sugar, that's going to make you cool. I mean, in the 90s, in the mid-90s, marketers switch from the dual message of saying it's healthy so that moms will read that, and it's sugar sweet for the kids, mm-hmm. to bypassing the moms and parents completely and just saying it's cool and your parents are not. This whole kind of marketing of cool to separate kids off, to target kids.
And you know? It doesn't outrightly say that about your parents.
And it, excuse me?
It doesn't outrightly say your parents are not cool.
It may not. It may. Your teachers may be not cool. The product is cool. The real world around you is either less or not cool. So it has this way of...
Or would be cooler with said product.
With said product, yeah.
Yeah.
So it starts very early to associate the buying of a commodity with the purchase of an identity. It promises you an identity through buying things, mm-hmm. and in that very process will deplete you of your spontaneous sources of empathy, of emotions. I think one of the ways that our consumption culture works is to embed the equivalent of computer cookies in us, substitute emotions such as coolness or other qualities, such that you're being brainwashed over and over, or brain rinsed, as I use the term in the book. Brainwashing, you know, is a time-honored method of beating people with a truncheon until they believe what you want them to believe.
Yeah.
But a commercial, you know, after all, 60 seconds, 90 seconds, it just nickels and dimes your soul. It takes a little bit. It's not even the content of a commercial, but the form. If you look at television commercials, an overwhelming percentage present a little scenario that you are inadequate. You're anxious, typically. Then there's the magic appearance of the commodity. And then there is the post-purchase commodity nirvana, happiness, whatever, complete identity. And if you replicate that thousands of times a day, I mean, we've had more than a doubling of the daily association of commercials. You know, that people are presented with 3,000 to 5,000 commercials of ads of all sorts today. It's more than double what it was 25 years ago. What are the implications of having that much propaganda placed in front of us all the time?
And people who avoid it, it should be noted, sometimes have trouble gaining acceptance from peers or assimilating into the larger culture, are seen as outcasts. And that brings us to the point you made about your student, that her friends were upset with her for not having her cell phone on. So how do you negotiate those things?
Yeah.
Well, it seems to me it shows even more why we need to grow healthy selves, capable of being autonomous, capable of being empathic and feeling their surrounds, feeling what others feel, but also being autonomous, of being able to stand up to peer pressure, of being able to say, okay, I don't have that thing, the latest thing that you want me to have, but I'm me, you know? And I think this is the challenge of parenting, you know? You could throw out the television, but when your kid's going to sleep over, they're going to be getting all of that exposure mm-hmm. anyway. It means, how can we remake our child-rearing practices and educational practices to better serve children? For example, you go in a supermarket. I suggested to my students, try walking down the cereal aisle on your knees, because that's the kind of view you're going to see from a little kid's perspective. And you'll see is sugar, and the healthy cereals are kept high that are hard to see.
Interesting.
The Kaiser Foundation study also did another study of children's commercials on Saturday morning children's TV.
Oh, yeah?
And they found that of the 8,854, if I remember correctly, commercials, do you know how many showed fruit or vegetables?
No.
Zero.
Oh, you will that's not, how many.
Yeah, you will not see a fruit or a vegetable on children's programming. And I think this is awful mm-hmm. because what they will yeah. see are all of the products of sugar that can hook them, you know, yeah. into a kind of a sugared identity and away from healthy food.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Walt Bodine Show on KCUR.
Yeah.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and Walt and I are having a conversation with Eugene Halton, whose new book takes a look at how consumerism, technology, and other factors have shaped American culture, and not necessarily for the better.
And what's the name of the book again?
The book is The Great Brain Suck and Other American Epiphanies.
Yeah. Okay.
You talk a little bit in the book about a camera society, which I thought was really interesting. Could you explain what a camera society is?
Well, it's a view of society as a voyeur, as a spectator. And I think it's implied in the inscreening of consciousness that we've seen, where you start to look at things as though you're watching a TV show.
Yeah.
You know, the novel and the movie based on it, The Being There, showed this wonderfully, where Chauncey Gardner lives his whole life in this enclosed mansion, and the owners of the mansion die, and he has to go out into the world, and he encounters a street gang, and the first thing he does is to hold up his television changer to try to turn them off as they approach him hostily, as if you can do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's as if we have that kind of attitude more and more, that it's as if life is a show that you can change the channel or turn it off. We evolved as humans in a consciousness of participation, of being in the picture.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, over the last few millennia, we gradually developed this view of more of a spectator consciousness. Perhaps writing is one of the key elements in that, where you start to look at something that's embedded and fixed. But certainly in our age, the electronic image has come to take a central place in that process,
go ahead.
And to literally inscreen our consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Are there sectors of society that are less vulnerable to this? Are there occupations in the world, or other things that can enable some people to be more immune to this stuff?
That's a great question. I don't know. I can think of some occupations where, obviously, when you have to deal with a screen all day in your job, you're more susceptible to that. Does that mean something else might, you know, be a better bulwark against it? I don't know, but maybe when people start calling in, there'll be some ideas. I'm sure there are.
So.
Even if Gina calls in,
I think I'll avoid calling myself today, but we'll see about that. I wonder though, you know, when we talk about technology, is technology really the problem, or are there other underlying problems that make us vulnerable to taking technology as a shortcut for more in communications, for example? Is the time, the restrictions on time that people have, or the distance between people, are those the real culprits, or is it the other way around?
Well, it might be the whole system, that a system that puts increased demands on our time that maybe is not a necessary way of doing it. I mean, if you look at the amount of work Americans have spent in the last, you know, two decades, more and more time at work.
Yeah.
Part of it is the changing nature of pay and all, but part of it is because consumption has gone up. Mm-hmm. People are buying a lot more, and they need to work harder to buy more. It's a kind of a treadmill that's not really necessary. People claim to not have enough time to cook their food, but they seem to have time to be able to overeat. How does this work out? Why do we rely more and more on fast food and seem to have less time to cook food, but then eat too much food? Or to go back to Walt's question, I'm not sure about occupations that might be a way of, a better protection against the over-intrusions of technology. But simply being at home is one way that we can take control of our technology. If we think of the home, I have a chapter in this book called The Art and Craft of Home, where I try to argue that just being at home is an art and a craft, a practice, ranging from the way we spend our leisure time to just the cooking of a meal. A home-cooked meal is always going to be the cheapest way to eat, but it's also going to be the best way to eat if we choose to practice it as such.
Yeah.
And food, I think, should be a form of awareness, a way of connecting to the world, a way of being ourselves. And we have this culture in place that wants to claim that food is just something to be done fast and effortlessly and magically just by purchase. And I think we lose a great art that we can practice in our everyday lives.
When we talk about the economy lately, there's a lot of talk about how people need to go out and buy when they can. For example, Christmas shopping, you know, whether that's up or down is going to dictate the success or failure of our economy, or so it seems from listening to or watching the news. And I'm just wondering, how do you envision our economy working? Not that it necessarily is working right now, but if people didn't consume excessively, if people didn't buy more than they needed, or if we did not manufacture more than people rightfully needed.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, George Bush and Dick Cheney after 9/11 gave as their recommendation of the best that Americans can do is to go out and shop. And that's an awful.
That was a awful, shock, wasn't it?
It was a shock and an awful recommendation.
Yeah.
It shows a sense of America as a place of commodities.
Yeah, materialistic dependence.
Yes, and we're a nation of citizens, of community. And what should have been said is the way to deal with times of trouble such as this are to strengthen the bonds of community. How can we relate to each other in better ways? How can we have better neighborhood associations?
Right.
And so, again, when it comes to something like Christmas, we don't have any obligations to buy things for each other at Christmas. We have obligations to relate to each other and to be with each other. And I think that's something that's a crucial antidote to our culture of consumption. Christmas is the chief sacred ritual of materialism in America.
Yeah.
It is the way we train young children that the acquisition of objects is a way to an identity and to happiness. Mm-hmm. It's the way we make people think that happiness can come through commodities. And it's wrong. There's many studies that show that of materialism and happiness that show that materialism does not bring happiness. Happiness is something else again.
Yeah.
What about you? How do you find happiness in your life? I mean, I know that's a very personal question, but it seems that with this being the focus of your studies, you would have some sort of way in your life of getting around this cultural tendency.
Well, many ways. I mean, I find happiness through my family, through friends, colleagues. I find happiness through making music, you know.
Writing a book.
Writing a book. One of the things I did this Christmas was I spent a day unshopping. I went up in my attic and I found a lot of old children's toys from when my kids were little that I, you know, they were hidden away up in the attic. I didn't even know they were there.
Yeah.
I filled up my car. I went to Salvation Army, and I did a day of unshopping, bringing in stuff that could be bought as Christmas presents.
That's good. Well, guess what? That music tells us that we're up to the halfway point in the show today. And as we do, we give out our phone number so that our audience, as they have been listening and taking all this in, can be ready to pepper you with some good questions here when we come back.
The number is 816-235-2888.
You're sure of that?
I'm sure of that.
All right. In that case, we'll be back in a minute. And we're back again. Okay. Now then, the second half of the show. Once more, the phone number to call.
The phone number to call is 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or if you're having trouble getting through, you can always email us, waltbodineshow@kcur.org.
Yeah.
Our guest today is Eugene Halton, the author of the book, The Great Brain Suck and Other American Epiphanies. He'll be talking at the central location of the public library this evening at 6:30, and we will be giving that information again at the end of the show.
Yeah.
You need to get your pencils ready.
Right downtown.
Now, while we're waiting for your calls and lining them up, we were just talking about how to have a really authentic experience, how to find happiness in a way that hasn't been mediated in some way by consumer culture and technology. You mentioned music as one way that you like to make music. Can you talk a little bit about music as authentic experience?
Well, I play blues music, Chicago blues. And
You play an instrument?
I play blues harmonica.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And I've been fortunate to be able to play with a variety of the top blues musicians in Chicago. Mm-hmm. I love this music. It's a simple music in some ways. It's not complex in chord changes. I have done gigs with a fellow by the name of the Tail Dragger, who was taught to sing by Howlin' Wolf, one of the great creators of Chicago blues.
Mm-hmm.
And we will do some songs from Howlin' Wolf that have no chord changes, and yet we deepen the groove throughout the song. If rhythm is the beat of the music, groove is the feel of the rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an incredibly deepening, entrancing process of improvisational music, where you must create and body forth the music as it proceeds.
Mm-hmm.
In my book, I discuss self-originated experience as one alternative to brain suck. Where you
self-originated experience?
Yes, creating your own experience, not individually disconnected from the social, but for example, in music, it's an ensemble that is creating the music, co-composing the music, in a sense.
Don't just stand there and listen.
Right. And well, sometimes stand there and listen, because sometimes someone else is playing something great. But everything in balance again.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, it's interesting because in our consumption culture, music is a key player in the selling of our consumption culture.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes a commodity. But music is a kind of a form of ecstasy. It's, you know, the word ecstatic means to stand outside oneself. And music can certainly throw one into that rapture. But what does it mean to listen to music while you're running, for example? You lose the rapture of your body in motion and that feel. You know, everything in its right place.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I wonder what our listeners think about all this. We've got lots of calls already, but tell us what you think about the struggle to have a truly authentic experience that's not your own, that's not inspired by a clever marketing strategy or a desire to send cool photos to your friends later. And let us know if you even agree that what we typically call progress is anything but. Maybe you don't agree. So give us a call at 816-235-2888. We'll talk with Susan in Independence.
Hey, Susan.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm so grateful for the opportunity to think about this, because I've been actually struggling with the idea of what else can we base our economy on besides the consumer society.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, the author, have you heard of there's a video out that's on, you can get online, called The Story of Stuff?
Yes, I've seen that.
Because it's incredible, because I guess I didn't realize that there was an intentional decision in the 50s for our society to become a consumer society.
Who made that big decision?
It's related to politics and also to the economy.
Hmm.
That, you know, that's what needed to be done after the war. But the sad thing is that it just disconnected us from ourselves. So I definitely agree. Another resource for people that want to find out or seek to live their life in this meaningful way is called It's Alternatives. And you can go online, www.alternatives.org, and it's wonderful to have different ways of thinking about, okay, what gives me joy? What helps me? And I think I was wondering if the author had any faith relationships that help in that process.
Well, if I could go to the first part of the comment, the second chapter of my book is called Out of the 50s, and I try to detail the kind of cornucopia that fell out of the post-war experience in America. I see that period as an establishment of what I call megatechnic America, a kind of a system coming into place that functions more on the rules of the machine and as such can be anti-democratic. Out of the Manhattan Project came big science, which required increasingly larger and larger chunks of money, often under the veil of secrecy and often under militaristic goals.
Yeah.
Also, the franchising movement came in. You remember we had the interstate highway system got developed, more spread of automobiles, of suburbs, franchising of food. You know, and when you read Fast Food Nation, Eric Schlosser details how a lot of these founders were great entrepreneurs who you know, their get-go got them much further than they ever anticipated. But at a certain point, their businesses started to turn into these machine-like corporations that start to dictate consumption as a way of life. And so, you know, I don't think there was any one cabal directing this process, but a kind of systemic turnover towards something more like a machine-like structure that created our consumption society.
It's interesting that she mentions a website that suggests alternatives for people, because that sounds a bit like that's another example of technology even feeding the alternatives to a technological consumer-based society.
Yes, again, technology can be a means of information and one that we should draw from when when it's right. I'm not a Luddite. I'm not saying that we should smash all the machines. Jerry Mander wrote a book called Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television. He wanted to just throw the whole thing out. Maybe he's right. I don't know. But I think that we can draw many useful kinds of information from media. I mean, we're doing it right now. This is a radio show. So, again, it's what is the proper balance?
Let's talk with Michael and Raymore.
Michael.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine. Go ahead, sir.
Okay. I appreciate what this author has done. I've been struggling myself for the last 15 years to debate the same issue, not only on a personal level, but as a society where we are going. And I think... this new presidency, hopefully, if slogan change somehow touches on a personal basis, hopefully will touch on a personal family basis, where the grandfathers, the grandmothers, the children's, the grandchildren's, and the fathers and mothers somehow can find a peace and happiness. And I don't think the corporation is going to bring us a happiness. The happiness belongs to us, and we have to challenge ourselves. Do we really need all this, what we are asking from the corporations to serve our services? And I don't think they can do for us. And that's all is my comments. Thank you very much, and I'll just drop
my
call.
Very good comments, sir.
Thank you.
What do you think?
Any comment on the comment?
Well, yes, I think, you know, the core idea of democracy is a life in common that that has a higher standing than special interests, than private interests. Mm-hmm. And that's why the life in common of the community should be served by corporate interests and not serve the corporate interests. So I think that the idea of an inclusive commonality is basic to democracy, and yet what we've put in place of that is an idea of exclusive distinction.
Yeah.
That you are you can stand out from the commonality by the purchase of this, by the acceptance of that. And again, we're talking primarily on a personal level, but if we move it to a societal level, the corporate interests have great lobbying power, great political power. They have the ability, in the early 70s to knock down an attempted ban on advertising, television advertising to young children. That almost went into place. It was knocked out by the lobby. So we it seems to me corporate structures are like technology. They are means to life. We cannot allow them to dictate our policies. And I think that's part of many of the problems that we've had in recent years, the whole deregulation of everything. You know, we've seen the effects now, the deregulation of the markets. But let's not forget there's been deregulation of food, of the meat industry, of all kinds of aspects of life in the idea of reducing governance. But governance is a part of the common life. We need, again, to find the proper balances, it seems to me.
Let's talk with Lori and Lee Summit.
Hi, Lori.
Good morning, gentlemen. This topic is really hitting home with me. You know, I'd just like to state that I myself at 52, I live for my passions and not possessions anymore. It's a form of spirituality to me, and I'm tired of taking care of stuff in my life, you know, all the stuff that you buy. I'm also facing, I'm a technology-challenged person, but all my network of friends and family are mad at me because I don't have the internet, number one. I have had it before, and all I got was junk mail. And in another example, I just bought a TV yesterday, and I had five gentlemen through the house trying to hook it up to the cable thing.
Yeah.
And we never were successful. Five different guys through the house. So anyway, sometimes I choose not to answer the cell phone because if I wanted to talk to somebody, I'd call them.
So yeah. You want people to communicate with you on your terms.
Yeah.
Yes. And like when I've been on the computer, pop-ups come up and people want to type to me. It's like, no, pick up the phone and talk to me in person. I don't want to sit here and type, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm fighting, kicking, and screaming into this world of technology. I'm a little bit young to be doing that because everybody is hip and savvy to it, but I just don't want to be enslaved by it. I don't want to be committed to, I mean, I'm in so many locations where people are so rude, talking on the cell phone or texting while I'm talking to them.
Yeah.
And their attention is not on personal relationships anymore. It's on stuff.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about this?
Stuff.
Well, I'd like to recommend to the caller that she might want to market a bumper sticker for her. It's a great slogan. Live for your passions, not your possessions, as she put it, is a great way of putting it. A few years ago, I did a call-in show out of Boston on self-storage, storing the self, you know, when the use of self-storage facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And one caller called in that a young woman, when she and a friend of hers are at the mall shopping and they see someone with this anxious look on their face, they turn to each other and say, TMS, too much stuff. So I think that idea that your passions should root your everyday life, not your possessions, is a great outlook.
And by the way, you should be aware of a chance to hear Dr. Walton expand more on this at the great downtown public library.
That's right. Eugene Halton will be speaking this evening at 6:30 at the central location, and he will be there with his book, The Great Brain Suck and Other American Epiphanies.
Yeah.
She also mentioned that these kinds of technology have a way of intruding on her life, that if she has the internet on, then everyone can suddenly contact her. Yeah. If people have their cell phones, there's suddenly all these conversations going on around her. What about the intrusion that you can't control?
Yeah.
Well, maybe, you know, sometimes when you have to have a cell phone for work or something like that, that can be difficult.
Yeah.
Then you have to get creative, you know, figure out how the battery will run out when you don't want to be interrupted or some other excuse, something like that, I think.
All right. Well, let's talk with Melanie in Leawood.
Hey, Melanie. Melanie.
We will get back to Melanie, see what happened there. But for now, David in Overland Park.
Hey, how are you?
Okay. Hi. How?
You guys have covered so much ground since I first started. I don't even know where to begin now.
Jump in.
I first called about the concept of technology as babysitter. We're working, and to me, I see this as a direct tie-in with the decline of good manners in society in general.
Yeah.
We're working on the fourth and fifth generations of kids raising kids. It used to be that, you know, the grandparents in the family either lived with you or they lived within walking distance. You know, the parents needed a night off. They always had somebody reliable that they could leave the kids with. Mm-hmm. People used their imaginations instead of the remote control.
But that's not how it is now.
No, it's not. I mean, I've tried really hard to teach my 13-year-old daughter that imagination is more than, you know, watching what's on the screen. She's an avid reader, and yet because of the way society has played its part in her raising, she would still rather watch the movie than take the time to read the book. And it's frustrating because it's the instant gratification thing, you know, that's pervading everything.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that is the problem. I mean, the screen is a highly seductive entity that can lure us into its fantasias, often with the promise that it's going to lure us into ourselves in the process, but can lure us away from ourselves. Again, there's nothing wrong with movies, but you know, if you see the movie instead of reading the book, you're missing the main way that the author of the book has intended the story to be told. And you know, I think that's again one of the transformations we have with this culture of the image. It's just so magical.
Yeah. Yeah,
it can show you any image at all, and who wouldn't want to be in a magic land like that all the time? But the caller is right that the cost for this is that it depletes our inner imaginative capacities. You know, we're not, when you read a book, when you read a novel, you have to make up your own pictures of what it is. I once had dinner with a Czech writer who was a friend of Milan Kundera, who wrote the novel called The Unbearable Lightness of Being. And he had been speaking to Kundera the night before, right after the movie came out, and he asked him what he thought of the movie. And he said, Kundera said, there's one scene with naked bodies, you know, and he said, I didn't like it. And the friend of his said, well, but it's in your novel. He said, but in my novel, I get to imagine while I'm writing it what they look like.
Yeah.
And in the movie, I have to look at these, you know, whatever's been done, and it overrides what my imagination is.
Hmm.
So, you know, we used to have checkout attendants who could do arithmetic, you know, and the convenience of counting machines took out that capacity. Similarly, that's one of the costs of the benefit of a fantasia. Omnipresent fantasia is that it may take out our indigenous capacities for imagining.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Walt Bodine Show on KCUR. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Walt and I are talking with Eugene Halton, author of The Great Brain Suck and Other American Epiphanies. If you're trying to give us a call at 816-235-2888 and having trouble getting through, you can also try emailing waltbodineshow@kcur.org. Let's talk with Richard in Lawrence.
Richard.
Hi, really great, timely program. I think this is something that's on a lot of people's minds as we kind of had almost a generational divide here sometimes about people that are constantly on phones and electronic devices and people that aren't. But my first thing is just a quick challenge to people listening, and that's for just a day, as you walk and drive around your neighborhood or your city or your work, look at the number of people that are on phones. When they're walking, shopping, driving, in a store, in a restaurant, just don't be on your phone yourself. Just look and count the number of people you see. And it's virtually every other person. Sometimes it's even more than that, that are on a phone. And your example earlier about the woman jogging and not paying attention to their surroundings, you just, sometimes it's dangerous, sometimes you're just missing what's around you, but you can't possibly pay attention to what's going on around you when you're on a phone like that. But my question is, getting back to what the author said about technology serving us versus us serving technology. I was in a doctor's office the other morning, and literally half the people in there were on a phone in some way, either with their fingers or talking or whatever, instead of like reading a book or reading a magazine. And that strikes me as a remarkable change from what things would have been 5 or 10 years ago. And my question is, are we sort of like approaching where we're watching TV, the equivalent of watching TV all the time from a mental activity standpoint? Because there's studies that show when you watch TV, your brain kind of flatlines or close to it.
Yeah.
The interactivity is just not there. And so when we're talking on the phone like this all the time, or clicking looking at stuff, you know, on the phone screen, checking messages, is that sort of like the mental equivalent of watching TV all the time?
Let's see what our guest can tell us.
Thank you.
Well, I think it is. I was talking to a colleague recently who was telling me of an ongoing study. I don't know the author, and it's not finished yet. But the neuroscientist was studying people's patterns of looking with use of cell phones, and noticed that they got a constricted visual field. Their consciousness is more in their ears and leaving their eyes. So they have a kind of limited – they're kind of like have their eyes on automatic, just getting – you know, major things. But what happens, at least what the early findings suggest, is that when you put the cell phone down, you retain a little bit of a habit of that. If you're using the cell phone a lot, you retain more of a habit of that. You start to change the way you look around at your surrounds. And so I think, you know, that is a problem that we, you know, and what are all these people saying in the doctor's office? You know, is it really vital information? You know, are they exchanging vital statistics? No, they're being social, virtually, and the cost of that is that they're not co-present. They're not in their circumstance. Maybe you don't want to talk with people in the doctor's office, but in other circumstances, maybe you do. I mean, just consider that this, you know, and to go back to the younger generation and who really, I think, are in the fascination of and grip of these things.
Yeah.
What does it mean to face the world through my face, through
the MySpace or Facebook?
Facebook or MySpace. I'm giving them.
MyFace works too.
MyFace or Facebook. There's no face there. It means that you're facing a faceless world, facing an increasingly faceless world. MySpace. Where is MySpace? Well, it's not here where I am. It's there in this virtual space. Again, virtual space is wonderful. You can communicate all kinds of ways that are hard to do or impossible otherwise. But what is the right balance of having the space you're in, your circumstance, be where you are, to be here in the circumstance, or to face people instead of facing a screen?
Andrea in Mission writes, "My husband and I have a 4-month-old daughter. This Christmas, we asked that our parents, her grandparents, put money into her college fund rather than buy gifts and toys. However, they believe it is their right to buy for their grandchild. Any ideas about how we get them to understand and respect our beliefs about consumerism?"
Well, you could first send them some warnings on lead in the paint and toys. Maybe that would ward them off a little bit. But, yeah, again... on their behalf, you know, money in a trust fund doesn't have the element of surprise, you know, the package and surprise. We all like the surprise of Christmas gifts. So maybe if they wrapped it. You know, and then the youngest kid is, of course, is only interested in the wrapping. But that's a tricky terrain to negotiate. How do you buy presents without buying into the materialism?
Right.
And again, something tangible is immediate. On the other hand, you don't want to give something tangible to create the expectations. You know, the kid that sees the wrapping at 1 and then knows that there's something inside by 2 and then by 3 or 4 screaming to get the more stuff. You don't want to go there.
Yeah.
I don't know. I would sit down with them maybe face to face and talk about it See if you can figure out something magical that's not buying into materialism. That's not an answer, but I'll leave you with the question.
There you go.
Dana in Overland Park is on the line.
Dana.
Hi. Thank you so much for bringing awareness to this issue of authentic experiences. That's something that's really important to me and my family. We have 2 young kids. And we found that we have to be really conscious and disciplined about making sure that we're not purchasing experiences such as Christmas or even purchasing the illusion of a happy home, which I think a lot of people here in the suburbs kind of do. They create that happy home from the outside instead of playing music together, doing games together, and creating the happy home from the relationship inside. And one thing we really focus on, anytime we have free time on the weekend or we want to go out and do something, I try to really ask myself, what can we do today that's not a bought experience? And it's really helped me to focus as a person on what I really value in my life. And one thing that's really come up is the importance of arts. And I've kind of become more aware than ever of what role arts play in society. When you take commercialism away, there really aren't that many things left to do. And there's nature, there's arts, there's game playing, there's, you know, taking walks with your family, talking, cooking a good meal. But the arts is something that has really increased in value to me a lot, and it's something I hope to pass on to my children.
Well, thanks so much for sharing that, Dana.
Sure. Thanks.
Thank you.
And now we've got Ken in Liberty on the line.
Hey, Ken.
Hey, this is Ken in Liberty. Well, Ken in Liberty. I want to say that I inherently disagree with the premise that technology is inherently cripples our social skills or inherently cripples our imagination. I totally disagree with that. I think it is a tool, and it's used as such. I don't think it, and obviously it can be used as a crutch. Obviously, internet gaming or internet or MySpace or texting can be addictive in the same way that, like gambling, for instance, is addictive, and it can be very harmful. It can be used as a crutch, and it can do those things. Mm-hmm. But I also think that it can enhance them, too, when used properly.
I'm going to let our guests quickly respond to that because we're running out of time, and then we'll wrap up here.
Well, I agree with the caller. I was not arguing that there's inherent disabling abilities in technology. On the other hand, on the other hand, it's how we use it. I'll leave it at that.
There you are.
Our guest today has been Eugene Halton, author of The Great Brain Suck and Other American Epiphanies. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks again. Thank you.
If you want to hear more from Eugene Halton, he'll be speaking at the central location of the Kansas City Public Library this evening at 6:30. For more information, go to the library's website, kclibrary.org.
Yeah, that's great.
Tomorrow, the food critics return to talk about cozy hangouts and lovable joints. And although it's time for us to sign off for today, you can visit us online anytime at kcur.org/Walt Bodine. You can also sign up for a free podcast of the show or listen to previous episodes using the Walt Bodine Audio Archive. That's kcur.org/Walt Bodine Archive. We had help today from KCUR's Kim Noble. The Walt Bodine Show is produced by Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Walt, that's it for today.
That's it. We just want to remind you that another great talk show has been set up for you today, and that comes up in just a few minutes, called Up to Date. So stick around.